A handful of tents in a New York park shouldn't have mattered. Yet within weeks of Occupy Wall Street's September 2011 launch, something extraordinary happened. Americans started speaking a new language. The 99% versus the 1% became shorthand for economic reality, spreading faster than any marketing campaign could achieve. This wasn't just clever branding. It represented 30 years of suppressed frustration finally finding words. A Pew study captured the shift. Two-thirds of Americans suddenly recognized strong conflicts between rich and poor, a 19% jump in just 3 years. Meanwhile, over 7,760 protesters faced arrest, while not a single banker was charged for the financial crimes that had devastated millions. This stark contrast revealed what Occupy was really about, exposing a system with two sets of rules, where power shields itself while punishing dissent. Something fundamental broke in America during the 1970s. For generations, even through the Depression, Americans believed tomorrow would be better, a faith earned through militant labor organizing and New Deal reforms that delivered tangible progress. Then the ground shifted. Manufacturing moved overseas while remaining wildly profitable for corporations. The economy transformed from making things to manipulating money, enriching financial elites while hollowing out communities. The 1950s and 60s saw remarkable shared prosperity, with all income levels rising together. But the 70s brought deliberate policy choices, deregulation, offshoring, tax restructuring, that concentrated wealth at the top while most Americans worked longer hours for stagnant wages. As wealth concentrated, so did political power. Congressional advancement began requiring massive fundraising rather than service and seniority. The gap between what citizens wanted and what government delivered became a chasm. Today's deficit obsession persists despite overwhelming public support for taxing the wealthy and creating jobs. Classical economists Adam Smith and David Ricardo warned about what's happening now. Smith believed a home bias would prevent merchants from moving business abroad at their country's expense, an invisible hand protecting England from neoliberal globalization. Ricardo saw the same danger, but hoped it wouldn't materialize. Over 30 years, it did. For the 99%, this meant harsh decline. For the 0.1%, unprecedented wealth and power. A 2005 Citigroup memo titled Plutonomy described the world dividing into two blocks, the wealthy who buy luxury goods and the rest whose only function is maintaining a state that protects and bails out the rich. This growing precariat, people living precarious existences, was celebrated by Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan as worker insecurity that prevents wage demands. When U.S. Steel closed a profitable Youngstown facility in 1977, workers tried buying and running it themselves. Though unsuccessful, it inspired hundreds of worker-owned enterprises across Ohio, seeds of genuine economic democracy. When Obama took over the auto industry during the crisis, there was an opportunity to hand it to workers for producing high-speed rail and infrastructure. Class interests and lack of mobilization killed that possibility. Constitutional amendments removing corporate personhood and money from politics require massive mobilization, not just legal arguments. The concept of person has evolved dramatically, initially excluding indigenous people, enslaved people, and women, then expanding to corporations while narrowing for undocumented immigrants. Could America turn fascist? Unlikely. The ruling class lacks sufficient force. A century ago, dominant classes realized they couldn't control populations through violence alone, shifting instead to controlling attitudes through public relations and consumerism, barriers easier to overcome than torture and secret police. The path forward involves concrete proposals with diverse approaches. Immediate goals: stop austerity, support worker takeovers, address climate change, and reform personhood concepts. Mobilizing Americans requires unglamorous community work, engaging churches, schools, and unions to build lasting power. Universal healthcare would eliminate deficits while meeting needs. Public campaign financing works if implemented by an organized public. What matters isn't the perfect tactic, but building movements strong enough to make any tactic effective. Occupy represents the first major public response to three decades of class warfare that concentrated wealth among the top 0.1% while democracy eroded. As Congress's approval plummeted, the financial sector thrived, while ordinary citizens struggled with longer hours, mounting debt, and vanishing wealth. Wealth concentration that translated directly into political power. Unlike the corporate-backed Tea Party, Occupy was genuinely grassroots, addressing inequality, financial misconduct, and bailout policies that rescued perpetrators while ignoring victims. The movement proposed reforms on financial regulation, transaction taxes, corporate governance, and tax policy, while building cooperative communities with assemblies, kitchens, libraries, and support systems, creating vital structures in an atomized society. America hasn't exhausted reform possibilities. New York City Council's unanimous resolution against corporate personhood shows Occupy's influence toward dismantling a century of judicial decisions granting corporations extraordinary rights. Worker-owned enterprises spreading across Ohio represent institutional changes addressing people's needs across political spectrums. Whether labeled reform or revolution matters less than their transformative potential. Anarchism means highly organized societies built on voluntary participation, not chaos. Worker-owned enterprises like Spain's Mondragon Corporation and Argentine cooperatives demonstrate practical models with democratic decision-making and elected, recallable leadership. These ideas trace through classical liberal thinkers like Adam Smith, who opposed dehumanizing division of labor, to Aristotle's democracy and Wilhelm von Humboldt's human development concepts. During a significant InterOccupy conference call, three critical objectives emerged: embedding the movement's message in mainstream consciousness, defending freedom of assembly, and challenging corporate personhood. The movement successfully transformed public discourse. The 99% versus 1 framework became deeply embedded despite hostile media. A Pew Foundation poll showed 66% of Americans recognized class conflict as major, a dramatic increase from previous years. Occupy's most profound achievement was creating vibrant communities demonstrating alternatives to competitive individualism. These communities established food kitchens, medical clinics, libraries, and educational programs, showing how mutual aid functions in practice. This challenged the gain wealth, forgetting all but self mentality corporate interests have promoted since the Industrial Revolution. The movement created lasting networks across students, unions, and environmental activists, bonds serving as both practical examples of alternative organization and crucial defense against state repression. The challenge lies in maintaining these connections beyond immediate protest, creating durable institutions sustaining long-term change. History's great victories, the 8-hour workday, civil rights, environmental protection, came from countless small actions, consciousness-raising groups in living rooms, lunch counter sit-ins, teach-ins that built networks of solidarity slowly until they became unstoppable. Occupy's real legacy isn't the encampments, it's the relationships and mutual aid networks established. When Hurricane Sandy hit, Occupy Sandy provided relief faster than FEMA. Rolling Jubilee started buying and canceling crushing medical debt. These aren't band-aids. They're proof that another way of organizing society is possible. The path forward requires sustained organizing in communities, workplaces, and neighborhoods. It means supporting worker ownership to challenge who controls production. It means building coalitions across movements, connecting student debt to healthcare to climate justice. Solidarity, mutual aid, and care aren't soft values, but the foundation of real power. The question isn't whether you can occupy a park, it's whether you can build bonds strong enough to weather difficult times ahead. If these connections sustain and networks expand, this moment becomes more than protest. It becomes the beginning of the world we want to live in.